Let's begin. Who are the yard sites? Yeah.
Okay. The first yard site is Rav Hirschsprung.
Rav Hirschsprung from Canada.
Montreal,
okay.
I know.
So what are the Talmidim of Rav Meir Shapiro?
Rav Hirschsprung.
Yeah.
Rav Hirschsprung knew my grandfather. He went to visit my grandfather.
Okay.
Great grandfather, yeah.
We need a periscope.
Who?
Sarah Palm, Rav Palm's Rebbetzin.
Okay.
And the third one is Rav Shamshon
Rebbetzin. Hirsch. Wow, so today's a big day. Three very big yard sites.
No pictures.
Three very big yard sites. Okay, I'll tell you, Rav Palm's son told me privately that at the end of her life, they had, in Kensington, they had a tree in the backyard. And they wanted to take down the tree. The city wanted to take down it because they felt the tree was a sakana in their back. And she strongly protested they should not take down the tree because she said every day, for years, she wakes up in the morning, she goes to the back, and she looks out of the window to daven shachris, and she sees that tree. And the beauty, the presence of that tree inspires her so much to the Niflois HaBoyrei, and it opens up her mind to daven with a great intensity. And it was a traumatic experience for her to hear that they wanted to take away that tree.
And the city cared?
I don't know what the end was, but he told me that the family never saw that, never knew that about. They never appreciated this depth she had in davening, and how much that tree was part of her look on life. And it was a revelation to the family. He said this to me, he told this to me privately. He said it was a very powerful revelation to the family. Like, our mother is a very holy person, and she hides it. She conceals her greatness. And that story shook them up. It's not in print. This story you're not going to hear in print. It's not in any book.
Right.
It's a private story. Okay, Rav Shashafel Hirsch, you don't need me to tell you. Okay, there's only a whole library of books on Rav Shashafel Hirsch. Actually, I have a new, someone wrote a nice new sefer. I have a new, from his work, new publication. I was actually read it this morning. I didn't even know it was his yard site. It's very interesting.
It is nine books.
Yeah. Nine books there alone. Rav Shashafel Hirsch is above and beyond. And Rav Hirschsprung was a very interesting person. A mayor actually introduced me to him. I never knew anything about him. He published a diary in Yiddish. A diary in Yiddish of his, he didn't publish. He wrote a diary in Yiddish about his experience in the war. And recently, about a couple of years ago, it was translated into English. And the translation is a fantastic, fantastic translation. It was done by a woman who researched every word of that. A lot of the diary was written with expressions from the Gemara. And this woman, who really does not appear to have had that background of knowing Daf Gemara, through the diary, she studied the Talmud to get a flavor of what exactly he meant to say in those
right.
expressions, and with the Yiddish. And she did a phenomenal job in translating in the diary for the Hamoinam. It's available in any bookstore in the Holocaust section, and it really gives you a fantastic flavor of what was going through the minds of the people at that time when they were running from place to place to escape the Nazis. At one point there, he said something very fascinating about my great-grandfather. He went to I think the Baba Vareba, and he asked him, what should he do? Should he run away? Should he go? And the Baba Rebbe said, go to the Reish Sharav. Go to my great-grandfather. Ask him what to do. He went to the Reish Sharav. The Reish Sharav was in a daze. That's what it sounds like. He was totally immersed in learning. And he stood by the door. And it took time until the Reish Sharav realized he was present. And then he asked him what to do. And he didn't really tell him what to do. He told him that he hopes that the war will be over soon. Or something along those lines. Very vague what he said to him. He didn't really give him a clear answer. Read the book. It's good history. It's very, very good history. It's a soft cover book. Okay, let's learn over here. Masa. What? Rav Hirschsprung. Rav Pinchas, Rav Pinchas Hirschsprung. He was a genius. He spoke to him. He was a genius. And after the war, he came. He survived the war. He came to America. He came to Canada. Became a rav, a very chashuv rav in Canada. He has the Eluyish children, and he's a personality. He died not that long ago. Today's his yard site. Zuchuso Yagen Aleinu.
Good. The mayor of the town there showed up too.
The whole city. Yeah, he was a big rav. He was a big personality. So Rav Palms Rebitzin, Rav Hirschsprung, and Rav Shamshin Rifol Hirsch, Zuchusam Yagen Aleinu. Let's learn today over here the Malbim. We are in the middle of the Malbim. We're up to the historical part of the Malbim. Let's start from Vihine Churb Ninve Hasheni. Let's start from there. It is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines down on page 537. 537, 6 lines down. We're learning about this very first pasuk. The Malbim taught us a fascinating pshat. And he said that this pasuk here, Masa Ninveh, Sefer Chazoy Nachum Ho'el Koyeshi, there are two parts to this book. There's Perek Aleph and Beis. Nachum has three parakim. The first pasuk we're spending a lot of time on because the first pasuk usually is a Pesach into understanding the entire Sefer. Once we get a flavor who the person is, where he comes from, and his mission, then everything in the book flows from there, so it's worthy. We're spending day three trying to delve in to have a much greater understanding of the first pasuk, which is the Pesach, the Mafteach, the key to understand this entire Sefer. And what we've learned, the last thing that we learned is the parish of the Malbim, which says that this pasuk is to be broken up into two parts. There is a Masa of Ninveh, comma, and then there is a Sefer Chazoin of Nachum Ho'el Koyeshi. Nachum Ho'el Koyeshi is going to tell us two different stories. In Perek Aleph and Perek Beis, he's going to tell us about the Churban of Ninveh that occurred from Yonah, and then Sefer Chazoy Nachum Ho'el Koyeshi is a prophecy what will occur at a later point of time after Nachum is no longer on this world. So in fact, you know, let's read from Pasuk from the beginning of Pasuk Aleph again. We'll go through quickly because it's in the middle. We'll start from the beginning of the Pasuk on the Malbim, page 537. Aleph Masa Ninveh HaSefer HaZeh Nechlak L'Shnayim. There are two prophecies. Echad Nikra B'Shem Masa Ninveh. What is that? V'Hem HaNevuah Shel Siman Aleph V'Siman Beis. Perek Aleph, Perek Beis. V'Hasheni, the second part of this pasuk, is what's called the Sefer Chazoin. V'Hasheni Sefer Chazoin. Chazoin. He has a Chazoin Shel Nachum. V'Hem HaNevuah Shel B'Siman Gimel. And that is Perek Gimel. Ki Ninveh Nechrava Shtei Pe'amim. The Yisoid, the principle, that the primary principle, the secret to understand this Sefer is to acknowledge that the city of Ninveh, the capital of the Malchus of Ashur, was destroyed twice. It was destroyed, it was rebuilt, and destroyed again. The Hamasa, Perek Aleph, Perek Beis, which we're calling the Masa, the burden, or called as a word for prophecy, Yisaper me Churban Ho'echad Shel Ninveh, the first Churban, this occurred before the Navi was born, or maybe during his own lifetime. And the second part of the Sefer Gimel, who li'itim rechaykais asher chazal churban shei asheni shel Ninveh. This is a vision of the second destruction of the city of Ninveh. When did that occur? It occurred in the first year of the Malchus of Nebuchadnezzar. That already took place after the life of Nachum. Shoya b'shana ha'rishon shel Malchus Nebuchadnezzar shebo nechrava legamri. V'hine, ha'churban Ninveh ha'sheni shoya ayde Nebuchadnezzar motzonu b'divri Chazal, the second churban we find in the words of Chazal. Av la'churban ha'rishon lo nimsa b'sifrei chachomenu. We do not find it recorded in Chazal. Right. We only find it here in Pasuk Aleph and Pasuk Perek Aleph and Perek Beis. The first Churban is recorded only in the words of Sefer Nachum, but Chazal never ever discussed it, even though they have psukim to draw from, for whatever the reason is, and that itself is a very interesting phenomenon. They decided not to talk about it. Very interesting. Why not? If you have psukim, talk about it. Isn't that a license to discuss and learn and gain insight? Fascinating. No. For whatever the reason, Malbim says, check out all of the Sifrei Chazal. Go through every single statement Chazal ever made. You will not find any reference. Do a search. You will not find any reference to the Churban of Nineveh, the first Churban that is recorded here in Perek Aleph and Perek Beis. Wow, that's quite a statement, quite an insight. Everything that Chazal spoke about the Churban of Nineveh was in reference to the second Churban. Loi, Avol Churban HaRishon, Loi Nimsa, B'Sif Rei Chachamenu, Rak Hu Dover Muskam, Misupa, B'chol Koros Tivrei Hayamim, HaKadmonim. It is in the history books, the secular history books, but not in the holy words of Chazal. The Eilu Devarim, let me read for you now a secular book. Let's take out, go to Wikipedia. Let's go online to Wikipedia and let's see what it says there. The Eilu Devarim, it says there, Sar Dan Apal, Melech Ashur.
Sardanapalus.
Sardanapalus, okay, Sardanapalus. Melech Ashur, Hoy Ish Bilial. He was an ugly, disgusting lowlife. Bilial is one of the nastiest four-letter words you can find in in Chazal. Okay, it's the combination of every nasty thing you can possibly say in any language. Bilial. Bili oil. It's a contraction of the words Bili oil. He has no yoke.
He was unscrupulous, it says here.
Unscrupulous, there no restraints, no moral compass, no nothing held him back. Every person to a degree has an oil, has a yoke, especially if you're a married man. Okay? Beli oil. What?
More like a leash.
A leash. Beli oil. There is no yoke. No yoke, not from man, not from Hashem. Nothing held. Zoilel visaveh. And if the word Bilial was not sufficient, the Malbim says, let me give you more four-letter words. Zoilel is a four-letter word, right? Sove is a four-letter word, right? When you talk about four-letter words, you have to know the four-letter words. Zoilel v'sove. Zoilel nasove. Four-letter words. V'roidev zima, another four-letter word. Zima. He pursued. Roidev is also four-letter words. We already read four times four. Four words that are four letters. Tipesh, that's a three-letter word. He was a fool. Vinishchas, that's a four-letter
word. He's not Samas Tipesh, it's a Malek.
You have to add in a yud between the test and the pay.
Yeah.
That'll make it four letters, okay?
He didn't have enough brains to have a four full letter.
Tipesh and a vinishchas, another four-letter word. Me'oid, very much. You can add a vod into the word me'oid. Okay, that's not part, that's just an adjective. Me'oid. Vayiskasher olav sar tzva bavel. And how was he destroyed? This tipish and a mashchis and a zoilel, a soyvei and a belial, all of these nice words. What was his downfall? The king, the general of Bavel, had it in for him. Vayiskasher means he formed a conspiracy. He formed a coup. But normally a coup is from the inside. So Bavel is from the outside. So it means they formed an alliance. There was an alliance. Nations, they got together in order to go to war against this unscrupulous individual by the name of Sar Dan Apal, according to the way we read over here in this Sefer. Vayiskasher Olav Sar Tzva Bavel Kamo. His name was Belezias.
Belisas,
okay. They know that is in Wikipedia. Very good. Asher Hoya Tachas. They probably got it from this. Asher Hoya Tachas Mem Shaltoi, who was Tachas Mem Shaltoi Im Sar Tzva Modai. Now it seems maybe Rabbi Chol, that the Sar Tzva Bavel was really a subordinate to the king of Ashur.
Yeah, because Ashur had conquered Babel at that
time. Oh, so Ashur was in charge. Babel paid homage. In the olden days, when you conquered a nation, you didn't destroy them. They just pledged their allegiance to you. They pay taxes. Today, when you conquer a nation, the attitude is you destroy them and then you take over and you remove everyone from the country, you put your people in. And that's not the way it worked in ancient times. Ancient times, when you conquer a country, you don't throw out the people because they run the country. You need someone to run the country for you. So you keep them in place and they just make sure they behave themselves and pay homage, taxes. So when this king of Asher conquered Babel, he let the people remain there, just they had to give him respect. But what happened, it was, like he said, a coup. And they rebelled against him. The general of Babel got together with other people, Imsar Tzva Modai, another nation. Shame, his name was Arbaces.
Yeah.
Okay,
Arbaces.
The Imshar Sore Hatzva, other generals, the army. Vayis'asu in Chelam ka'arba meos elefish. 400,000 people. Can you imagine? A big army. That's quite a big army.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, Nineveh was a big city.
Wow. Okay. So that for those times as well, that's a massive army. 400,000 people. It's not to be believed. That was just the army. Okay. Arba meos elef ish. 400,000 people. Massive army. Li lochem al Nineveh, to go to war against Nineveh. Hamelch yotzel likrasam. The melech came out, meaning that sar.
Sardanapalus,
he came out like Rasam Vayach Bochem Chalolim. Many people died. Vayirdoi for some Argvul Eretz Kastim. He pursued them until the land of the Kastim, Babel. That's where Babel, that's like the capital of Babel, Kastim. Vishamamdu Hamordim. Vinoidalchem Kiyotz Chayal Gadol from that city, whatever that city is called, Azor HaMelech. And then the army, the tide, the people came to support the king of Ashur. Vayishluchu shluchim likrasam lifatoisam liyos itam bikoshrim. Okay, well, the other way around. Okay, and then they sent shluchim towards them to the army in order to appease them to change sides.
The rebels.
So he was powerful. So the king of Ashur, he pursued and seemed to be victorious in overcoming the 400,000 soldiers that were trying to defeat him. And he was winning. And he chased after them, and he was fighting in their land. But then the tide changed. The rebels sent some shaluchim to the army,
This other army that was coming to defend
Ashur. The Hamelech lo yoda mizem u'mo. He did not know what was going on. They tricked him. Ubotach al adirav haboim lo azro. He trusted in the mercenaries that were coming to assist him. Vayishtu vayishkiru. They drank and they got drunk. Vayakumu hakoyshrim aleihem balayla. And the rebels, they rose up upon them in the middle of the night. Vayaku kol chel Hamelech. Vegam chel Hamelech shiyatzu likrasam imsar tzevaoi. Shalman, Achi, Ishtoi, Naflu, Amulchama. It's a very complicated war here. It seems like that this king was married to power and money, and those people came also to defend him, to help him, because he was part of the family. And they were also defeated by the rebels who knew what they were doing. V'chol asarim asher hayu tachtav, mordubo. They rebelled against the king, vayifriku ulo, and they loosened his yoke. Va'oz niskar hamelch v'chelo hanesharim be'ir Nineveh. They were locked up. They were under siege in Nineveh. Ashachayso ir bitzu was a fortified city, the last stronghold. U'nachar chidekel saiveh, it was surrounded by the water of chidekel. Va'amoridim tsaru alo ir shaloi shonim. V'lo yachlulo, it sounds like Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim, Nebuchadnezzar laid siege to Yerushalayim for 3 years, 2.5 years, 2.5 years. So here, the Babylonians laid siege against the capital of Nineveh of Asher for 3 years, but they were not successful. Then what happened? Vehame chashvim amru lemelech, and the sorcerers said to the king, Shekolzman shlo yehapech l'nahar chidekel l'oyev, if the river does not turn, lo tilokeidu ir. That as long as the river, okay, there's some type of sorcery, as long as the river is still supporting the king, they're not going to succeed. V'alzeh botach v'lepachad mera'ah. So the king Nineveh, this king, the Sar, how do you pronounce his name? Sardanapalus. He was told by his sorcerers.
It's probably a Greek version of the name.
Okay. He was told by his sorcerers that as long as the river is in your favor, is working for you, you're going to be okay. Va'yachrei shalashonim avar hanor eskvuloi va'yifreitz b'chay ma'asoyir kechatzi parsa. The river flooded. The river flooded against the wall of the city for chatzi parsa. I'm not sure what that means exactly over here. It's like 2 miles, a mile and a half. Va'yarem elch kichafach hanor ilo oyev loy va'yispahel ma'od va'yom anoash. All hope is lost. The river flooded. What this means exactly, I do not know, but somehow the river went out of its location by a chatzi paras. The paras is 4 mil.
Overflowed.
4 mil is 3 miles. So a half of a mil.
He says it's a mil is between 2 and 3 miles.
We know almost a mil is 3/4 of a mile.
62. Not a Persian
less.
Okay, different types of mils. Okay, I don't know. Okay, whatever it is. The river flooded. The river flooding was an indication in the rules of black magic that the river is no longer serving the king. The river is also joining the rebellion.
Because it's protection, because you have to cross it to get there.
Is that what it means? Okay, I don't know. Okay, fine, okay, there's a moat, there's some water supply, whatever, I don't know, whatever it is. Something went wrong with the river, there was a natural disaster, and that was seen as an indication that the king is no longer in the forces in Shemayim are no longer supporting the king of Ashur, and he is in trouble. And the king said, Noash. Noash means we are in a lot of trouble. All hope is lost. He commanded to put in his palace piles of wood and fire. Ha-shegal ufi lag shav. He took his wife. The shegal means the queen. The shegal means the queen.
Not in a nice way.
Ufi lag shav, and ufi lag shav, all of his women that he lived with, who atzmai olu kulam al hamoikeid vayisarfu vo'esh, they commit suicide. They all died in fire. Better than be captured and be taken slaves and be humiliated. They commit suicide. It sounds like Hitler, Yimach Shemo V'Zichro. Hitler, when it all came to the very end, so he took his wife, Eva Braun, that was her name?
Yeah.
Eva Braun, and supposedly he killed her first, and then he killed himself.
The dog also.
The dog also? He lived with the dog. Hitler lived with the dog. He lived in Mishka Behema.
Some people say he got away with submarine.
Some people want to say, there's a lot of research. There's a lot of research, Rabbi Isai. So the legend is, they've taught the world that Hitler, he commits suicide. There was one person with him. There was only one person that he had with him. And that person also was told to leave. And supposedly Hitler, he shot himself and he burnt down. And the person that was with him, he incinerated the entire house, wherever he was. The problem is that they have even the skeleton, and the skeleton they have there is the skeleton of a they assume to be a 13-year-old girl. So what they think was his skeleton is really the skeleton, this is what it says in the conspiracy books, of a 13-year-old girl, and supposedly Churchill told Roosevelt, Hitler is not dead. Okay, they have that he's not dead, he's alive somewhere. That's been undeclassified. Okay? And they have eyewitness reports that he was somewhere in Argentina.
Oh, sure.
Okay, so all of this is all conspiracy. And who really cares? What difference does it make anyway? And there's been enormous research to try to dig him up. And I told you once, the person that's leading this research, the only reason why this appeals to me is because I told this to you many, many times. Kut Chazer is the person who did the research. I think it's a Shomer Shabbos. There are a lot of people who do research like this. And even they found something very recently. They found a tunnel very recently, which was the missing link in how he could have gotten away. They actually found evidence to make it all theoretically possible. And when they said to this person, what are you wasting your time on this? You have nothing better to do than to go and do research. You can make a book, you can make some money, who cares? Get it over with, he's dead. No matter what, he had Parkinson's. Hitler had Parkinson's. And there's no way he could have lived past the mid-50s. There's no way he would have survived past the 1950s. So who cares? He's dead. Dead is dead. So he says, no, no, it's very important to me to do this research and to prove that he was alive. Because if he was alive, he would know, he would have seen the establishment of the state of Israel. And that would have been an incredible revelation, incredible revenge. It would have been a revelation that Am Yisrael is chai v'kayam ad kedei kach. They have a land of kibbutz goliyah. It's a place to return to. That would be a degree of satisfaction. And you should know something. We've over the years since I've said this, we've learned there's a lot to it. There's a lot of Mamori Chazal that support that concept. I can't tell you now at this moment, chapter and verse, but there's a Mamori Chazal that for a Rasha to die and to see in this world his failure contributes to his punishment in the next world. Leaving this world seeing the Yad Hashem enhances his Gehenna. So this fellow I became a fan of his. Although what you say to the average person, it's laughable. What have you been drinking? What have you been smoking, inhaling to start to make these crazy conspiracy theories that Hitler survived the war and he escaped to Argentina and was living somewhere, who knows where? What are you saying to such narishkeit? But there are people that have spent their lives doing research to prove that this is correct, and the evidence they have
it's
is
not necessarily correct, it's possible.
Possible. And the evidence that they present is not something to be ignored. I'm not saying it's right. You're not going to go up against the whole world, what the whole world believes. The whole world believes one thing. You're not going to, it's a little bit foolish to say that you know better. But
well,
the
all based on the Russians who made the discoveries, supposedly, and they were the ones who said that he died, and we don't necessarily trust it.
Listen, I'm not a conspiracy. I don't believe in conspiracy theories. I'm not from that chevra. I really am not. But the evidence that they present in these articles, I didn't read the books, but I read a lot of articles on this, are very interesting. They're very, very interesting. And it's definitely worthy to pursue, to see what they say clearly, and to hear a rebuttal. I would like to hear a rebuttal, a good rebuttal. And the religious concept behind it is absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating that Hashem kept him alive to show him Medinas Yisrael. It's a very fascinating concept. Okay, so it's a religious concept. It's not just a...
But from all this, these types of leaders, they don't leave the place alive. They kill themselves.
Right, that's what it says over here. That's why I'm telling you this. Because it's almost the same exact thing. Look what he did. He took his wife. Hitler took Eva Braun, his dog, and they killed themselves, and they burned them the bodies.
Yeah.
It's exactly what he did over here also, the Zolbazach.
Yeah. Even the generals which were disgraced in the German army, not disgraced, but they were demoted, they would kill themselves.
Right, they would kill themselves.
And Japan is very famous
Right, exactly. The scientists were in high demand. America went... That's there's a lot of ugly stories. 2020 on the Americans very much wanted them alive. The science, why? Because they wanted their brains. They wanted the technology. They had incredible technology. I once watched a YouTube video, and they had a plane. They had this very high tech. They have it. Germany they had this fighter jet.
Yeah, the first jet.
And the Americans cannot figure out ad hayom hazeh how they did it. And they show this whole video. They're trying so hard, spend an enormous amount of money using the technology of the day to recreate what they had. And they still do not know ad hayom hazeh how at that time, in that those years, they were able to invent this. Today they can do it, of course, but that piece of technology that they had available to them, they can't figure out how they were able to do it. And so obviously they had a lot of talent, a lot of super geniuses working for them, And all of the governments of the world, when the war was over, secretly did not want to declare them as war criminals and lock them up and kill them, put them on trial. They wanted to secretly give them new identities and smuggle them out of Germany,
right,
bring them to their country, and have them work in a laboratory for the government, including the United States.
Yeah.
And there was a big, this goes back probably 30 years ago,
yeah,
with John Loftus.
That's where he made his name.
By doing the research, and he found that the government did a lot of ugly things by taking, smuggling these scientists into the country. These are Nazis, because
with
all these ugly things, he discovered all this. And it wasn't only the United States who did this. All the countries of the world tried to get away with doing this. But the generals wasn't that exactly. The generals and the political leaders, they had no use for.
No.
We have no use for them. So they knew there was no use for them. They killed themselves. Because what value was their life worth when the war was over?
And that's generals.
What?
We have enough generals.
So that's what it says over here. Exactly, there's nothing new. The Malbim says that's exactly what the king of Ashur did when he saw the war was lost. It was a siege for 3 years. And when his magicians told him that the river is now rebelling against you, means all hope is lost, he made a massive fire, a massive bonfire. He burnt his palace. And he committed suicide with his wives and concubines. The Oivim Kavshu Esu'ir, indeed the enemy conquered the city, V'lo Yosholchu Es Yodam Babiza. It says something very fascinating, that the enemy did not touch the spoils. V'lo Yrotzu L'hara L'yoshvei Ho'ir, Ki Amush Lo'ibo Rak L'hashmid Espeis HaMelech, Rak Anshei Ho'ir. They're not here to go and kill you. They're only here to go and kill the king. They're not here to go harm the people. That's very interesting. Rak Anshei Ho'ir Nofel Aleihem Pachad V'yenusu Kulam V'yazvu Esu'ir K'midbar Shemama. The people themselves were so terrified, they ran away. And they abandoned their beautiful homes and all of their wealth, hefker. V'ho'oyev heikim tziyun shalbuz v'cherpa l'hamelech sar dan apal l'ois l'mas ha'ra'im. They established a marker of shame, a hall of shame.
A big
monument.
Sort of a monument, but it was like
a shameful monument.
Yeah, it was like, if you can imagine, like something covered with graffiti, that's pretty nasty.
Something nasty in order to put him to shame. The chol tzionei hakavot shayumarim al hamelech shavu vayitetzu. All of the statues, like Saddam, and all of the paintings and the pictures and all of the honor that they previously gave to this egomaniac, they destroyed. We saw that happen with the fall of Iraq. They destroyed them. The markers of honor show you modim al melech shavu vayitesu vayisimuhu lois vilim shalim, and it became a sign and a proverb that if of korban. If you want to have a model in an example of korban, look at what happened to the kingdom of Ashur. Ze toichen hasipur hanimsa b'chol sifrei divrei hayam kulam pe'echad. That's what it says in Wikipedia. Go look it up. That's what it says in Wikipedia, right?
Probably
right?
So.
Yeah. So he's saying over here is, and what is so fascinating is, this is what happened to the kingdom of Ashur. It's going to allude to this in the Psukim and Perek Aleph and Perek Beis. Yet Chazal, Chachmenu, Zichroinim Levracha, in their holy works, never spoke about it. Read the Psukim. Whatever it says in the Psukim is enough. It's not important for us to discuss this. What's important for us to discuss is the Chorban, the second coming Chorban of Nineveh, which would take place later. What is later? Later means two things. Like we said yesterday, it means in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, and Nevuah means in Yemos HaMashiach. The Chorban continuously is unfolding in the land of Ashur based upon the second Nevuah. Avol Mosai Hoya Hadavar, when did this happen? Uve Ezezman, Loinucha Lehatzil Mipihem Davar Nochoinu Borur. We know what happened, but we do not know when it happened. Everything that we just mentioned, this nice long, this elaborate story of the siege of 3 years, of the river, of what the magicians told the king and what he did by burning down his palace with his wives and committing suicide, and the aftermath of the army entering and the people running away and making a hole of shame and destroying all of the honor of the king, we do not know when it happened. V'hamivu'arim yoimru kemelch sar dan apalku esar chadoin, someone to suggest that he went by many names. Like, that's not something uncommon. We find it all the time that people had, even Yosef at Tzaddik, he had Sofnas Paneach and was Yosef, okay? We learned last week, Asher lo yoda es Yosef. I know who Sofnas Paneach is, but I don't know Yosef. Okay, a name captures an era. A person lives a full life. He really lived many lives. Think about it. A person is zoicha to live a full life, a full active life. So there's no question when you're in elementary school, you had one life. When you were in high school, you had a different life. When you were in college, you had a different life. Your first years of marriage, there was another life. Then when you had children, was another life. Then when your children got married, it's very common when you think back in the past, wow, that was a different world. That was a different time. I had different friends. I had different values. It's a different lifetime. I was known by a different name. I had a different name and I was known by a different name. It's the same thing in Tanakh. We find here many of the kings, they went by different names. The different names represent different eras of their life. You find that by even Rabbi Akiva, even by the Talmidei Chachamim, you find different periods of his life. He had different outlook on life. Look at the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim, how old was the Chafetz Chaim? No one really knows how old he was when he died. We don't know because we don't know when he was born. He was probably something who was over 100 years old. Miyuish Chafetz Chaim, Oyev Yom Lirois Toiv. If not him, then who? The person that taught Klal Yisrael to be Nizir in Lashon Hara. He himself said it would be a chil Hashem for him to die young. So he said about himself. He spent his whole life working, promoting Lashon Hara, and the bracha for Lashon Hara is a chavetz chayim. So if he's not going to live long, then who is going to live long? He said about him, it's amazing. So the chavetz chayim, we don't know how old he was when he died. It's very likely, new research seems to indicate that he was over 100 years old. Even though in the books they'll tell you that he was in his early 90s or his mid 90s, it seems it's not correct. He was a lot older than that. In any event, there are a lot of contradictions about the Chafetz Chaim in his Hanhogos. And the answer always given is, he changed his mind. He changed. In this tikkuf of his life, he did this. In one tikkuf of his life, he made a bracha on the tefillin shel Rosh. And another tikkuf of his life, he didn't make a bracha on the tefillin shel Rosh. He changed. Every healthy person changes as he goes along in his life. Now, if you change too much, that's not healthy. But there's a certain normal degree of adaptation and change that a healthy person goes through as he ages. So when we find contradictions in the history, in the hanhogos, in the conduct, and in the things that he said in his lifetime, it's not a contradiction. He lived a very long life. And over his life, he changed his hanhogos. He changed his outlook. Now that's someone very recent. You only could imagine going back in ancient times when people lived fuller lives. People really lived. They didn't just go through the motions. And certainly, they had different. The same person many times we find in Chazal is the same person. It's just that he had a different name. Why did he have a different name? Because every 5 years he was a different person. He was. They said about Rav Hutner. They said about him. I never met Rav Hutner. I never really saw him. I never knew him. But there was never a biography written about Rav Hutner. Why not? So there are two reasons. Number one, it would be so much lashon hara. You couldn't get away with it. Rav Moshe was a tzaddik. You know, Rav Moshe. There's no lashon hara Rav Moshe. So you can write a biography. Rav Hutner was a very controversial person. Okay, he had a lot of arguments with people. So to write a biography would not necessarily be so simple. Number two, okay, that's not nice what I just said, but that's really true as well. But number two, I have no charot to say that. Number two, there's another reason why they always say this because he changed so much. He changed mamash from year to year. He that was his nature. He continuously changed. So to write a book about him, you really need to write many books. You need to write a book about him, what he was like before he came to America, what he was like when he arrived in America, what he was like when he was teaching in RJJ, what he was like when he started teaching in Chaim Berlin in the high school. And then as he got a little bit older, he took over the yeshiva. And then his life when he became more involved in Klal Yisrael with the Aguda, and his life when he went to Eretz Yisrael, back and forth. And each tekufa, he was completely different. Completely different person, not the same person. He was very, he viewed himself the Talmud of Rav Kook. He held the Rav Kook. He was a Zionist, there's no question about it. He was a very strong religious Zionist when he was young. When he came to America, there's a document, document asking his friend at JTS to help him get a job. This is go look online, you can see the letter online. Begging him, I need a job, can you help me get a teaching position in JTS? This is nothing to be ashamed of, it's a fact, okay? And then he got a job in RJJ. What happened there? It's not so clear. There's not too much known exactly what happened in RJJ. He was already in RJJ for a period of time. Why did he leave? Was he told to leave? Or did he leave on his own? Okay, why did he leave RJJ? Was he fired? Very possible. Okay, they don't want to talk about that. Or did he leave on his own? He came to what was Chaim Little about in those days? Chaim was on the verge of bankruptcy. Chaim was on the verge of totally ready to shut down. What exactly was his role in Chaim Little? Rav Shurkin. He met up with Rav Shurkin. There was a rivalry. A lot of this stuff people don't want to talk about because I don't know why. This is historical facts. There's a lot to learn from all of these things. Okay, there's a whole tkufa with Rav Moshe. There's a tkufa with Rav Satmarov. There's a tkufa with bells. There's a tkufa with his attempt to make a yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. Each one of these periods is fascinating. Fascinating. It's full of depth. His role in Agudas Yisrael, there's no question about it. He shaped the Aguda that there is today. Agudas Yisrael that there is today, that made the Sima Shas, there's no question about it that his mark is there. What exactly is his mark? Where is it? No one talks about it. You're not going to hear about it. But there's no doubt about it if you do the research. His mark in molding and guiding the future hashkafa of Agudas Yisrael was there. Each one of these periods is a world to itself. And this only comes to shed light. If this can be true for a person living in our generation or the previous generation, al achas kama v'kama, ben b'noishel kal v'chaymer, when you deal with the Nevi'im, and you deal with Nebuchadnezzar, HaRasha, who's a super, super complicated person, even probably 10 times, 100 times more, in what they did in this world, in every year of their life. Chazal say, in the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, he did this. In the second year, he did this. In the third year, he did this. What are they telling you this? So it sounds like President United States, the first year, what did he do? I don't know. Second year, he did this. No. That's not what it means. Don't compare the President of the United States to Nebuchadnezzar. When it says that in the first year he did this, that itself is a lifetime. That was the sum total accomplishment of what would it take any other person multiple lifetimes to achieve. In the second year, he did this. It's a different person. It's a whole different ballgame. In the third year, he did this. He might as well have had a different name, a different mother, a different father for what he did in the second year versus what he did in the first year. Because it's so super complicated. If you knew the person and you knew the era and you knew what he did, you would not be able to wrap your mind around how could it be the same person who did this in the first year and did this in the second year, and this in the third year of his malchus. It's complicated. So here when he writes over here, that someone say that this person's name, he is this same person, you have to appreciate the depth of what that means. That it was not the same person, that they were the same person. Because we want to identify the time period. Let me find the place over here. When was it? Okay, I'm reading 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines from the bottom of the page. Page 537. Al Mosai Hoya Hadavar Uve Ezizman Lo Nuchal Lahatzil Mipiem Davar Nochonubar. We cannot find a clear answer. Vamavarim Yoimru, some who are knowledgeable will tell you. Kia Melech Sar Dan Apal, who is the same person as Esar Chadoin Hamuskar Bakosov in Sefer Melachim and in Yeshaya. Asher Moloch Tachas Sancheriv, he was the king after Sancheriv. Sancheriv went to conquer Yerushalayim, he failed. He came back home and he was killed by his own children. His own children killed their father. And the Asher Bonav Hikuhu Bacherev. And then who became the king? Not his son. The one that became king was Esar Chadoin. Esar Chadoin was also known as Sar Danapal. Vayomu shehu shem murkav sor, which is asur, esar, napal. Napal, who is chadoin? Chadoin means pull, means to cast down. Haniska bedivrei hayamim. Ulefi zehoya ma'aseh zeh besoif yimei Chizkiyahu, oy bimei Menashe, vuhu maskim ledas chazal, shenachum nibe bimei Menashe. If we're going to say that is correct, that this nice history that we find in Wikipedia took place after the death of Sancheriv, which coincides with the beginning of the life of Nahum and the time of Menashe, the king of Yisrael, then indeed everything does indeed fit into place. So this person, this person who is not mentioned, who in Wikipedia is called Sar Dan Apal, here in the Nusach, in our Lashon over here, that you'll find in Wikipedia, if we are going to say that he is the same person as a Sar Chadoin in Tanakh, then yeah, everything stims. Everything fits, the piece of the puzzle come together. But that's a secret, because in Wikipedia, it does not say this piece of information.
It's a theory.
In Wikipedia, we know this to be a fact. There was a king called Sar Dan Apal, the king of Assyria. We do not know the time period. If we are going to match him up with a Sar Chadoin, then a lot of questions are indeed answered. Ulam hamayin b'sifrei hakoros mashma shehaya kodum zman harbei. If you look in the history books, Wikipedia, and you look at the footnotes, and you look at the sources, it will seem to indicate that this person, Sar Dan Apal, lived long before, way before, much before the time of Esar Chadoin, and then we got problems. Then the pieces do not connect. Then zman harbei ve'ein biyodeinu lahachriya, we have no way to know. What really happened? Rak im hoya kodum, if it did happen earlier, nosa hamasa al chuban shoya kodim liyamav, then it would have to indicate that this that it says in Perek Aleph and Perek Beis, describing the Churban of Nineveh, is something that Nahum is recording a legend that took place long before in the past. Vim hoya bizmanoi, then nosa hamasa al chuban shoya liyamav, during his lifetime. V'alzeh omar ma'asan inveh, that's what it means, the ma'asan inveh, v'oid, period. So that is the ma'asan inveh, okay? That is the hakdama to ma'asan inveh. V'oid chazach izayon al churban hasheni shal ninveh sheyiyye bimei Nebuchadnezzar. That is a prophecy, a chizayon. A chizayon is a prediction for the future, what's yet to happen in the future. That will happen later on in the time of Nebuchadnezzar. V'alzomar sefer chazoin shehechazoin hu leosid v'anachnu nefaresh hakesuvim maskim b'chol ho'efanim. We're going to learn the perush of the pasuk according to all interpretations. The Malbim says, you just come with me and I'll take care of you. I got you covered no matter what happened. I will give you the proper understanding of this sefer. Just travel along together in my company. All right, so we learned over here quite a bit. This malam over here is absolutely delicious.
The kings didn't have a diary, they didn't keep the history.
They did. They did. Divrei Hayamim. They did. Even Jewish, the kings, they said, Al-Kain says in the Sefer Melachim multiple times, Halahim Kisuvim al Sefer Divrei Hayamim. That does not mean Sefer Divrei Hayamim. Our Sefer Divrei Hayamim is not what it refers to when it says in Sefer Melachim that if you want to know all of the details of the Malchus of this particular king, go look and see what it says in Sefer, the Sefer Divrei Hayamim. That's not the Divrei Hayam on the shelf here. It's
King's Archives.
King's Archives. Where are they today? Gone. Disappeared from the face of the earth.
The Megillah says
Megillah Esther.
Right.
It says that the Persian, Haloihem Kisuvim al Sefer Divrei Hayamim, Lamalchei, Modai Ufaros. Where are those Sefer Divrei Hayamim? Gone. Also destroyed.
There's a lot of research in the outside world. It's called the Battle of Nineveh, 612 BCE.
612.
And they have old Babylonian scrolls. They have old Roman.
Does that correspond to the time?
Yeah.
The time of Menashe?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, so. When did it happen? It's a fact that Nineveh was destroyed once, before the Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the second destruction. When Nebuchadnezzar arrived on the scene to destroy Nineveh, that was the second destruction of Nebuchadnezzar. There is no question about it, he says. It's muskam al-akol that there was a massive first destruction of Nineveh. The only question is exactly when did it happen? Did it happen during the lifetime of Nahum, or did it happen before the lifetime of Nahum? But it happened. Okay, that's all that's called a masa. Masa is the past. A masa of Nineveh, period. Then we come to the sefer of Chazoin Nachum Ho'el Koshi, of the future that will happen after the death of Nachum in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, when he will come to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Before he destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, he first destroyed the kingdom of Ashur and took control. Okay, now let's take a look at the Mamor Chazal, Pasuk Aleph, on page 536. Masa of Nineveh, Sefer Chazoin Nachum Hu El Koshi, Masa Nineveh, Sefer Chazoin Nachum Hu El Koshi, Kel goes down to the second Pasuk, Kel Kano V'noikeim Hashem, Noikeim Hashem, Hashem, he's running through the Pesukim ahead. He's running ahead. Let us read what it says over here. It's going to say in the next Pasuk. Kel Kanoi, Hashem is a God of vengeance. Vinoikeim Hashem, Hashem takes revenge. Noikeim Hashem, repetition. Hashem takes revenge. Hashem Erech Apayim Ugudol Chosed. Hashem also has compassion. Goyer Bayom Hashem shouts at the sea, and the sea floods the people. Call the Yom, that fits very well with the story that the Yom over here would refer to what? It would refer to the Chidekel. Now the Yom, we normally translate the Yom as an ocean, the Mediterranean Sea, the Atlantic Ocean, okay, a sea, an ocean, but a river like the Chidekel, the Euphrates, is not something that we typically. We don't translate typically as a yam. We translate that as a river, a nahar, a river, not a yam. However, that's not always correct. More look, even the Yam Suf, was the Yam Suf what we today in English would translate as a sea. It's most of the commentators seem to indicate that the Yam Suf was really a river. It was really a small river, in fact, that flowed inside of Egypt, not along the coast, not along, you know, where is the Yam Suf? What is the Yam Suf? Today does it even exist? It's very possible that it dried up. All of these wadis that run down in Egypt, on the southern part of Eretz Yisrael, don't exist anymore. They've global warming, whatever you want to call it. Dr. Fruchter, welcome.
I don't
Good to see you. Look very good. So these rivers, we know from satellite images, that there used to be many bodies of water running through the southern part of Eretz Yisrael on the border of Egypt. They have indentations in the earth. We can see from satellite imaging, and it's clear as day from what we know that it used to be a powerful body of water running down this part of the region. Where did this body of water go? Gone. Disappeared. Why did it disappear? Changes in whatever it is. No, but there are certainly that today they don't. There's no time. Never. Right. That there are certain rivers. High for a mikvah. Is it a Mayon? Is it a mikvah? Shmuel. Right. So, but there is no question. Even all that said, that being said, there is definitely today. Go online. You can see this stuff. Not making this stuff up. There are many areas in the border between Egypt and Eretz Yisrael where we can see clearly on a map from the imaging of a satellite, modern technology, that it had to be years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, there were massive bodies of water flowing down this region. Where did these bad waters go? Why did they dry up? Whatever the reasons they may be. And it's very, very likely that one of these bodies of waters was dried up is what is used to be the Kriyas Yam, Yam Suf. Okay? It's very, 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 very possible. Now, if that's the case...
I saw in in Israel now they discovered a river that they never seen before, like
on the ground.
Up to 6 miles long, which
it's
runs
not a river.
It's a garbage, and they were showing in the video recycle. A lack of water going into the Dead Sea. Full of mines. Nobody could see,
it. It was a dump for trash. And whatever they dug out from the river, the recycling, they dumped it in one spot, and eventually it made its own path.
The question is, the point I want to make is, when we say the word yam, what does yam mean? In English, we translate it as a sea. So a sea is not a river. But the truth is, in Chazal, the Yam HaGadol verse Stama Yam.
A body of water.
So when we say that the Kriyas Yam Suf, it doesn't necessarily mean the Mediterranean Sea. Doesn't mean. But there are other massive bodies of water. We don't really know. It could have very well been many. It could have been a very small body of water. It was a small body of water that miraculously opened up. It's not the point over here is we have over here a puzzle. Here, I just want to connect what it says before. We had this history. In the history, it says here that there was this superstition that if the Chidekel, as long as the Chidekel is functioning as expected, as what they're accustomed to, there is no way the enemy will be able to conquer Nineveh. When the Chidekel flooded, a Chatzi Parsa, whatever that means, I have no idea what that means. It flooded the Chatzi Parsa. That was such a frightening revelation to Sardanapal. What did he do? He committed suicide. Together with his wives and concubines. Why? Because the river flooded? Just because the river flooded, you're so scared? They believed in the river, Ad Kedei Kach? They sure did. So when we're going to learn in the next pasuk that Hashem gave a shout to the Yam, which we like to translate to be a sea, an ocean, and here we read the story, the historical account, and the Yam it wasn't a sea. No one would call the Chidekel would call it a sea. It's called a river. Whoever said that Yam in Tanakh means a sea? Yam means a body of water. Mayim comes from the word Mayim. And the Yam could very well mean even a river. When Hashem gave a shout at the river and the river flooded, that was enough of a reason for Sardanapal to get frightened to commit suicide. Let's read and finish the Chazal. Goy b'yam kol parsha zo eruve devadim misha omar ze loy omar ze. Okay, that's Tosefta. So this is something very important to keep in mind. This is a hakdama to the Sefer. This is a hakdama to Chazal's introduction to Sefer Nachum, that don't expect there to be consistency. We are spoiled in our generation. It is served to us on a silver platter. Everything has to make sense. The words of the Pasuk have to go in order. The chapters have to go in order. There has to be a structure and a paragraph that we can understand. Chazal are giving us an introduction. No. That's not the way you learn Sefer Nachum. In Sefer Nachum is a collection of psukim, and one pasuk has nothing to do with the other. Don't expect there to be a pattern which will make sense. I'm sure the Malbim will try to make sense out of it. But Chazal, who came long before the Malbim, are telling us, beware, the psukim are not going to connect. Misha Omar Zeh, Loy Omar Zeh. Okay, to be continued.